Hello, and welcome to the next in our series of Bristol Classical Podcasts, looking at Virgil's Aeneid. Once again, I'm Professor Neville Morley. I'm hosting this, which means basically I sit here listening to what our expert guests have to say on the subject and just putting in the occasional question. I'm joined today by Professor Duncan Kennedy, who's a professor of Latin literature here in the department, and Juliana Holzhauer-Conti, who's one of our MA students studying for an MA in reception and critical theory. They're going to be talking about Aeneid Book 1. One place we can start things off is the simple question, why does Book 1 start where it does?
Well, the Aeneid's got a very complex story to tell, running from the fall of Troy right up, in fact, to the age of Augustus itself. So one question that will have faced Virgil is, do I tell this sequentially in chronological order, or are there advantages to starting at a particular moment and flashing back and flashing forward? And what Virgil does is to present us initially with the figure of Aeneas 7 years after Troy has fallen. And Juno has seen him setting sail for Italy and is enraged at his progress. And so she stirs up a storm. She gets Aeolus, the king of the winds, to release the winds and set up a storm. And this will shipwreck Aeneas on the shores of Carthage, where he will meet Dido. But one of the advantages of starting at this point is that it allows us to see Aeneas some years after Troy has fallen. He has been 7 years wandering around the Mediterranean, and when the storm comes, he's filled with despair because he says to himself, well, why couldn't I have died in front of the walls of Troy, fighting for its survival? And the implication of this is that the last 7 years have been pointless, that he has been pursuing what he thinks he should be doing, finding a new home for the Trojans in the western land, and that's virtually all he knows. But 7 years have passed, and he seems to have made no progress. So he looks at himself facing death and says, well, what have these last 7 years done for me? Why didn't I die with my colleagues when Troy fell? And so it presents us with Aeneas really at his lowest ebb. And in some sense, his progress is upwards. He may not always see it that way, but he is on track towards arriving in Italy and setting in train the events that will, 1,000 years later, lead to the, not simply to the foundation of Rome, but to the rise to power of Augustus himself.
What I find very fascinating about where Book 1 of the Aeneid starts is the fact that it starts in the middle of action, in medias res. It shows the Trojans going through an immense amount of suffering and pain. So it, because of the storm, and because, as Duncan said, the trials of travelling for 7 years when they don't think that they're actually going to get anywhere, or where they don't actually think they're making any progress. I think it reveals Virgil's debt to Homer, because obviously the first time we meet Odysseus, he's crying on the beach of Calypso. So to meet our hero when he's at his lowest point, I think is very interesting in the context of this. But it also, I think, the distance of time between the Trojan War finishing and to where we start the Aeneid has been long enough for the events at Troy to become mythic in themselves. When we meet the Carthaginians, or when Aeneas meets the Carthaginians, he comes across the Temple of Juno and he sees the frieze of the Trojan War. And that is very important because it shows that the Trojan War is already important then. It will come to be even more important in the lives of the Romans, but it is important to them at that point as well. And shows how much rides on their actions, and shows how much the digression with Dido can have the potential to ruin, essentially, what Jupiter prophesies for the Trojans.
Picking up on the point that you made there, Dido, of course, is familiar with the events of the Trojan War. As you say, they have become mythic for her, and that's very important in terms of her recognition of Aeneas and her welcome of him in book one.
So it's not just a continuation of the story of the Trojan War, or a continuation, you know, one of the many stories coming out of the Trojan War. It is also a commentary upon the stories of the Trojan War, in other words, Homer.
Yes, in some ways Virgil is playing a few tricks here, because of course Homer writes at a distance of some centuries from the Trojan War. So although the events of the Trojan War for Aeneas and for Dido are already gaining that mythic status, Homer has not yet written about them. They have not yet found their canonical form.
So it's not that Dido has read Homer?
No. But in the depiction of events from the Trojan War on the Temple of Juno, Virgil manages to play with the sense that these are already promulgated throughout the whole world. And he is playing upon this notion that they have the kind of everlasting fame that is associated with their celebration in epic verse. But in fact, if you think about it, Homer is himself still in the future.
And does this give Virgil the opportunity to put forward an alternative version?
Well, yes, you can develop a quite interesting argument along those lines, because Homer writes, let us say, a few centuries after the Trojan War. He sees the significance of the events of the Trojan War in the light of their impact, perhaps, on the Greeks. But what Virgil does, writing anything up to 600, 700, 800 years after the Homeric epics, is that he says, well, the story as told by Homer has more to it than Homer could ever have realized. Because Homer was unaware of the foundation of Rome. He didn't see that the fall of Troy was not an end in itself, but rather the beginning of a much bigger, greater story, which culminates in the great events of Roman history, the foundation of the Roman Empire, the progress of the Roman Empire towards worldwide dominion. So, in some sense, he can preempt Homer's interpretation of events by saying, no, if you look at it in a much larger historical context, it has much greater ramifications than you would ever have guessed from Homer's telling the story.
It's almost as if Virgil chose to go a different path to Homer, because Homer wrote the Iliad and then the Odyssey, following that specific man's journey home. And then now Virgil has chosen to follow Aeneas and his journey to find his home after the Trojan War. Yeah.
And also, of course, Virgil can play off against the way that there are two epics associated with Homer. And one of the things that he does in the very opening line of the Aeneid is to suggest that his poem is going to be an amalgamation of the Iliad and the Odyssey. Arma virumque cano, he says, arms and the man I sing, where arms represents the warfare of the Iliad and the man represents the hero of the Odyssey, except the hero of this epic is going to be Aeneas, who not simply finds his way home as Odysseus does, but actually founds a dynasty that is going to have major reverberations on the history of the whole world.
And is there a sense, actually, in which Homer's being reversed, that it's now Odyssey followed by Iliad?
Well, in some sense, yes. But many people have said that the first six books of the Aeneid represent Virgil's Odyssey, and books 7 to 12 represent Virgil's Iliad. But if you think about book 2 of the Aeneid, then you're back to Troy, you're back to the Trojan War, you're back to the familiar figures from the Iliad, not the Odyssey. Mm. And so from that point of view, though Virgil does combine the two, he doesn't do so in any schematic sort of way.
I mean, lurking behind all of book one is sort of setting up this bigger story that this is all about Roman history. I mean, are there specific ways in which that's being done?
Clearly, one of the key moments in Aeneid 1 is when Venus is so upset by the shipwreck and by the distress of her son Aeneas that she goes to Jupiter and says, have you broken your promise? You said that Aeneas was going to make it to Italy and a great future awaited him. All the other Homeric heroes who are scattered around the Mediterranean are finding their places to settle. What about Aeneas? Have you broken your word? And Jupiter says, no, I haven't. And that's the point at which he sketches out to her what the future holds, that there's going to be 3 years in Italy for Aeneas, and then his son Ascanius will rule over a city that he founds, Alba Longa, for 30 years, and then that there are going to be a succession of kings of Alba Longa who will reign for 300 years, so we get 330, 300, and at that point Romulus will found the city of Rome. And from there, then, Rome will rise to power to the extent that it will conquer Greece. And so it's almost as though the Trojan War will have a rematch. And the result of the match is going to be reversed. Rather than Greeks conquering Trojans, Trojans, now in the form of Romans, will actually conquer Greece. And this will only be, however, the first stage in their great march towards worldwide domination, Imperium sine fine, an empire without boundaries.
Can we talk about some of the, I suppose, the important themes in Book One? And Juliana, what would you highlight particularly?
Well, I was going to pick up on the question that you picked up before, actually, when you said about echoing or foreshadowing Roman history. I think that this book is very interesting because it sets up the episode with Dido, and the episode with Dido, well, foreshadows, in inverted commas, the war with Hannibal, because Dido later on in the Aeneid curses her descendants and the Trojan descendants to meet again in war, as opposed to in what could have been construed as love this time. But what I found very fascinating was the way that Book One ends is Dido saying that her descendants will long remember the day that Dido and Aeneas met. And that brings in the fact that a lot of what could be positive in this book is actually negative. Her love is described as a poison, for example. Her love for Aeneas, that is implanted in her by Cupid, is described as a poison as opposed to as a good thing.
One of the interesting things about the way that Book One ends there is the way in which the characters involved in the action are never fully aware of the consequences of what their actions are going to be. And so Aeneas is in the depths of despair at the very beginning of the book because he cannot see his actions in any larger context than the situation he's in. Dido makes the offer of a shared kingdom to Aeneas and to the Trojans, and she sees this as a potentially happy outcome. But of course she cannot see what's going to happen very shortly in terms of her relationship with Aeneas. Now we, the readers, are perhaps more like Jupiter within the poem, that we are constantly looking at the characters' actions in terms of what we know their consequences to be, whereas the characters are acting not knowing what their consequences may be. So Dido thinks, well, people will look back on this as a memorable day. Now she thinks of this because she thinks it's going to be the start of a happy and harmonious relationship between Trojan and Carthaginian. Little does she know, but of course we know, with the benefit of hindsight, that it's all going to turn out terribly.
So we've got foreshadowing, we've got hindsight, we've got this sort of looking back to, you know, sort of Homer. I mean, how much is this sort of setting up the relationship between Aeneas and Dido?
I think the relationship between Dido and Aeneas starts off in a very fascinating way, because Aeneas begins by hearing about Dido. He hears about her skill, he hears about her ingenuity. Her brother murders her husband for greed for gold, and Dido retaliates by taking the gold that was her dead husband's, because after her husband appears to her in a dream or as a ghost, as a vision, revealing how he died and where he hid the gold, Dido takes the gold and takes some of her people and to go and found a new land. Venus tells all this to Aeneas, So Aeneas hears about this woman who is like a king. She can lead her people to safety, to a better life. He sees her before he meets her. He is hidden by Venus in a cloud of mist or fog. And he sees her amongst her people as they are building the city. They're setting up the Senate House. They're setting up a theatre, which is exactly what Romans would do if they were founding a city. So he sees her at her best. He sees her setting up a city, something that he wants to do. He says that how lucky they are that their walls of their city are already rising while they have been travelling for 7 years and they still don't know where they're going. And so it starts off in a very, I don't want to use the word interesting again. So their relationship starts with almost their roles reversed. She is the role of a king in leading her people, in giving them their city that they need. Whereas Aeneas doesn't know where he's going. He is at the mercy of others and is jealous of this woman who seems to be completely in control, which will then completely change in the next couple of books.
Yes, he's hugely impressed, but at the same time the figure of Dido as the leader of her people is potentially a rather difficult one. When he first catches sight of Dido, he's been looking at the pictures depicted on the Temple of Juno that she's building. And the last person he catches sight of in these representations on the temple is the figure of Penthesilea, the queen of the Amazons, who is a rather weird figure. And the juxtaposition of Penthesilea, he looks at the temple, he sees Penthesilea, the next thing he sees is Dido. That juxtaposition is slightly uncanny, and it does remind us of the way in which, within the world of the epic, women aren't meant to be leaders, and generally they are people who cause disruption when they're leaders. Thinking ahead to Roman history, well, then the figure of Dido seems to foreshadow the figure of Cleopatra in Virgil's own time, that she too is a leader. She too is a queen who is leading her people. And, of course, she casts her spell over Mark Antony. And similarly, Dido seems to cast a spell over Aeneas. And one of the things about the gender roles in the Aeneid is that men are meant to be purposeful. Men are meant to be the people who get things done, whereas women are a disruptive feature. So Dido is a very positive stateswoman, but in some sense she reverts to type later in the poem, that she becomes overwhelmed by erotic madness, and this makes her lose the qualities that we first see her with. But this also operates on the divine level, because Jupiter is the calm, rational, planning deity. He knows what the future holds. He knows how he wants things to turn out. And it is the female divinities, Juno at the very beginning, trying to put a spanner in the works. And then Venus, who should be on Aeneas's side, seems to act in Book One in a way that's very counterproductive. And one of the reasons for this is that she's much more interested in her own private vendetta with Juno rather than with the fate of her son and the well-being of her son. So these gender roles are being played out throughout the Aeneid, and the Aeneid is suggesting that they then have their reverberations through history, and that one can see counterparts to Aeneas and Dido in figures in contemporary history, like Cleopatra.
One could argue that Venus acts against the detriment of the Romans themselves. In making Dido fall in love with Aeneas, she therefore leads Dido to being what she sees as betrayed. And so when Dido curses her descendants and says that her descendants and Aeneas' descendants will not meet happily again, we could see it as Venus making the war with Hannibal happen in the first place.
Yes, and again, like the human characters, do not always see the consequences of their actions. No. They don't have the bigger view. So I think quite a few of the deities don't have the bigger view as well. Venus seems to act very much to the moment. She seems to see, oh, I can get a tactical advantage here if I do this. And it doesn't become clear to her that she is messing up the bigger picture by acting as she does. And the only figure within the poem who seems to have that kind of full grasp of what the consequences of action are going to be is arguably Jupiter himself.
But at the same time, this is giving sort of an explanation for the enmity of the Carthaginians and the Romans, and why is it that Aeneas ends up moving on? Because in a sense, you know, we know Aeneas has got to move on, because otherwise he can't found Rome.
At the very beginning of Book One, Virgil as the narrator virtually summarizes in the first sentence what the subject of the epic is, and he's pointing us to look not to the immediate events that we're getting, perhaps in Book One, but always to keep our eye, like Jupiter keeps his eye, on what is the end of all this, what is the outcome of all this. And the outcome of all this is the foundation of Rome. But he also says, so great a task it was to found the Roman race, indicating that it's not straightforward. We may know the story, but that when you think things are going, even perhaps swimmingly, at their best, you must look beyond them. You must see whether they are contributing towards the culmination to which we're being pointed, or whether they don't. And so, like Aeneas, we have to question what is the consequences of any one particular action. Can we look beyond the immediate situation and keep the bigger picture in mind?
That's a really good place to end. We are just about out of time. Well, thank you very much indeed to you both. Tune in again for the next exciting episode, Aeneid Book 2.